Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, December 11, 2012, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on cybersecurity and the legal limits of hacking back. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. All expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Our experts for today's call are Stuart Baker and Professor Oren Kerr. Stuart Baker is a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of Steptoe & Johnson. He served for 3.5 years in the Department of Homeland Security as its first Assistant Secretary for Policy, where much of his work concerns cybersecurity. Oren Kerr is a professor at the George Washington University Law School, where he teaches criminal law, criminal procedure, and computer crime law. Professor Kerr posts regularly at the popular blog The Vault Conspiracy. Their complete bios, more complete bios, have been made available to you on the Federalist Society website and also in the notices you receive for this call, so I'm not going to introduce them any further. And with that, Stuart Baker, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thanks, Dean. I thought what I'd do is start with the policy reasons we're having this discussion now, because I think that actually once you understand the policy reasons for being interested in hacking back, the legal issues are actually easier and more malleable to achieving the policy result that I think is appropriate here. We face crisis in terms of cybersecurity, which not everyone fully appreciates, but which is gradually working its way into the fabric of all our lives. I was recently at a meeting with a FBI agent and a government rep, and asked them, so of the AmLaw 100, how many do you think are likely to be compromised by Chinese or other government hackers? And he thought for a minute and said, well, at a guess, 100. And that's based on actual experience watching data leave law firms and large companies in the United States over several years. We're not going to solve this problem by building better defenses, even though that is what we have been doing for the last 10 years. We live in a world where we know that the best safes are measured by how many minutes they will stand up to safe crackers, and the very best safes last 60 minutes, and yet we're trying to construct computer defenses that will last forever against attacks by people who otherwise can't be stopped except by having better safes. And that's implausible and unlikely ever to succeed. We need the equivalent of a police force, a mechanism for deterring and punishing attacks rather than simply defending against them. The good news in that area is that unlike 4 or 5 years ago, we've begun to discover that the security problems that we have are also the security problems that our attackers have, that their computers are vulnerable to intrusion, and that we can learn a lot about them simply by hacking the hackers. And recently, we've begun to see actual pictures taken with the video camera on their computers of Russian and Chinese hackers. This is the beginning of identifying and ultimately sanctioning people who are engaged in these activities. The problem with that strategy is that the people who should be doing it at the FBI and elsewhere are barely able to keep up with the attacks on their own infrastructure, let alone gather intelligence about attackers who are going after private law firms and private companies. If we want to put the resources into those kinds of very promising new approaches to computer defense, we're going to have to involve the private sector and let the private sector supplement the resources that the government is able to bring to bear on the problem. And that is what makes the idea of privately hacking back the attackers such a lively issue today. It's something that we increasingly looks as though it will work, and the only thing that might work, and it's something that is already beginning to pay off. The problems that people raise about this are, I think, overstated. Again, on a policy level, the immediate resort by opponents of this is to the notion of vigilantism or to the notion that there's going to be massive collateral damage. I think both of those are overstated. We have many forms of private law enforcement or privatized law enforcement today, from private investigators to repo men, and all of them need some supervision, but civilization has not ended by allowing people who think their crime isn't being fully investigated by the police to hire people who will gather information for them. Similarly, the notion that there's going to be massive collateral damage, I think, has been widely overstated, probably because in the early days, the assumption was, well, we'll just start firing back at the computer that's attacking us and see if we can break it. And there are a lot of reasons not to do that, including the fact that people are smart enough to use somebody else's computer as the last jumping off point for an attack. But the idea of hacking BAT for purposes of gathering information, gathering evidence, compromising the people who are engaged in the attack so that information about them can be used by your government to sanction the attacker strikes me as unlikely to produce massive collateral damage. It's certainly not going to turn off the computers at an intensive care unit, which is the hypothetical that's often used when I talk about this by opponents. And so it is possible to do this with some supervision under some rules and in a fashion that is unlikely to cause collateral damage, and it could be a game changer in our otherwise losing game of cybersecurity. So if you think that it's a good idea to do this, then the question is, well, is it legal under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act? And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that because I think that's a remarkably flexible statute that would easily allow you to make the argument that what you're doing is with authorization. The entire statute says it's illegal to access a computer, to modify a computer without authorization, and authorization is not defined. There are hints in the statute and in the treaty that implements that statute internationally that what authorization means is, are you entitled? Are you doing what you're doing with right or without right? And it seems to me that in a circumstance where you are responding to someone who is breaking into your computer, stealing your intellectual property, or causing damage to you, that to say accessing his computer is something that you don't have a right to do, aren't authorized to do, aren't entitled to do, simply begs a discussion of, well, where does right lie? And I'm reasonably confident that most courts faced with the question of who has the better rights here would say, certainly not the hacker who's complaining that he's been hacked. So I will stop there. We'll probably end up talking about the law in more detail, but it seems to me that that frames the issue. And Oren, if you want to take it from here, it's yours.
Great. Thank you, Stuart. This is Oren Kerr speaking. I wanted to respond to Stuart by focusing on the legal issues. So Stuart offers a policy argument and then a legal argument, and I'm going to reverse the order because I think the law here is relatively clear that what Stuart is proposing is illegal. Whether it should be illegal or not, we'll get to in a minute. But Stuart mentions the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, so I just want to explain why I think this statute makes digital self-defense or hacking back or however you want to call it illegal. The Computer Fraud and Abuse Act was initially enacted in 1984, expanded in 1986, and then has been expanded since then. And it's basically a computer trespass statute that has both civil and criminal parts to it. And the basic idea is that if you own a computer, you get to control who accesses your computer. And if somebody accesses your computer without authorization or exceeds authorized access to access your computer, then that is a crime and also can lead to civil liability. And it's basically harnessing the idea of trespass, just like trespassing onto somebody's property is physical entrance without consent. The Computer Fraud and Abuse Act is sort of trying to enact the cyber version of that, is trespassing onto somebody else's computer. What that means is that the owner or operator of the computer has the right to control who has access rights and can say certain people are forbidden or are allowed to use the computer. And there's a lot of debates in the courts as to exactly what principles that means. For example, can a computer owner just have terms of service that say you're not allowed to do something? Does that mean that conduct that violates the terms of service is without authorization? Or do you need to set up a password gate and have this sort of hacking in the kind of conduct that is without authorization? And exactly what authorization means. There's some ambiguity as to what steps the computer owner needs to take in order to have the conduct accessing their computer without authorization. With that said, what Stuart is talking about is saying that you're allowed to hack into somebody else's computer because it's a good thing to do or a right thing to do and therefore should be an authorized thing to do. I just don't think that's how the statute works. This is a basic trespass statute. The owner of the property controls what is a trespass. And if I have a computer and somebody hacks into my computer, maybe uses they guess a password and they enter in that way, or they use some sort of script or something that bypasses the code-based restrictions protecting my computer, that is exactly the kind of conduct that the statute was designed to prohibit. So it seems to me that the basic act of hacking into somebody else's computer, even if you think you have a good reason for it, that's generally going to be exactly what the statute prohibits, and so it violates the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Now, there are a couple possible legal arguments you could make that would reach a different result in some limited circumstances. And I think in particular there's some affirmative defenses like necessity. Those of you that may remember your first year criminal law course may remember cases on necessity, which is somebody who, for example, trespasses in order to save a life or take somebody's property but to serve some better good, some greater good. And it's basically utilitarian doctrine that says the law will excuse certain minor crimes in order to achieve a greater good goal. And that may apply in a case of hacking back if a party is accessing somebody else's computer but has this greater purpose. It's a narrow defense, and these sorts of affirmative defenses in federal court are on somewhat shaky ground. But that's the kind of doctrine that I think responds to the concerns that Stuart raises, and even if that doctrine applies, it would mean that hacking back is generally illegal, but there may be some specific circumstances where it's legal. I did want to talk about the policy issues that Stuart led with. It may be true that this statute is too broad and the statute should allow certain types of intrusions into others, other computers in these sorts of specific circumstances. The really tricky issue to my mind is what exactly are the circumstances in which we want victims of computer crimes to be able to hack back, and exactly what does that mean? So we need to ask ourselves, what kind of trigger do we have in mind? Who should be allowed to respond? When should they be allowed to respond? What exactly should they be able to do? And the concern I have with Stuart's creative theory of authorization is it seems to be a green light that just says, okay, anyone is allowed to do this because we don't know what the statute actually means. Therefore, the statute kind of means nothing. If you have a good reason to hack back, you're sort of right, and therefore you're with right, and therefore you're authorized, and therefore go for it. And that strikes me as the wrong approach. If we want to have a statute that allows some sort of counter-hacking, we'd want to be very specific as to what those circumstances are. And so what we would need to do is have some sort of amendment to the statute that specifies exactly what those circumstances are. And I should point out that the current version of the statute actually seems to allow at least some sort of counter-hacking, some of this hacking back. There's a provision of the statute called Section 1030F, and it says, this section does not prohibit any lawfully authorized investigative, protective, or intelligence activity of a law enforcement agency of the United States, a state, or a political subdivision of a state, or of an intelligence agency of the United States. In effect, the statute exempts government investigations. And so that means that the government is allowed to hack back. The government's allowed to figure out who's behind this intrusion and trace the computer back to the Chinese hacker who may be behind this. It's just we don't want private individuals to do this. That's one plausible line. Maybe there's some other ways of doing this, but I think it'd be important not to just say, okay, anyone who feels that they might have been intruded upon, go for it. I think we want a narrower tailored approach. And there are other possible tailored approaches we could have. So let me throw out another possibility. The definition of a protected computer under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act is incredibly broad. So the statute prohibits unauthorized access to a protected computer, and as originally enacted in the 1980s, the thought was that a protected computer, at the time called a government interest computer or federal interest computer, was a computer that had a specific connection to interstate commerce or the United States government, and over time that definition has broadened and broadened and broadened. So now, any computer in the United States is a protected computer. It's covered by the statute. And the statute also covers computers outside the United States, which can be regulated under the Foreign Commerce Clause. So what that means is basically any computer on the planet that can be regulated under the Constitution, as far as the Commerce Clause and the Foreign Commerce Clause will go, is covered as a protected computer. One way of limiting the statute, if you wanted to allow some extent of hacking back, would be to say that certain computers outside the United States are exempt. So before 2001, I believe, the statute was not at all clear that it covered computers outside of the United States. And I think what Stuart is mostly talking about is hacking into computers that are servers physically located outside the U.S., not inside the U.S., and Stuart, you can maybe clarify if you think that your rule should apply also to intrusions of other computers that are, you know, servers in the U.S. But one way of limiting the statute would be to say it doesn't apply to computers abroad, at least in some circumstances. So I'm sympathetic to the concern that Stuart mentions. I think it's pretty clear under current law that the hacking back is generally prohibited. And I think it's a bad idea to just open the door and say anyone who wants to or who feels personally that they have somehow been hacked or intruded upon, green light. I think we really need to have, if we're going to have a response to this, that goes beyond the federal, the government exception in 1030F, we'd want to have something pretty specific and narrowly tailored. So that's my reaction. Stuart, I'd love to get your response.
If I can give just a short response, I will, and then maybe we can take questions. Well, I'm glad. I think we actually have gradually narrowed our differences here. But I think the fundamental problem with the way Warren has laid out the question is he continually said, well, under the Baker reading of authorization, anybody who feels he's got a higher moral right can just break into the other people's computers. But in fact, there is a criminal statute, and just feeling you have a better right does not guarantee that you are going to persuade a court that what you did was authorized. And so I don't think we're likely to see massive numbers of self-appointed vigilantes breaking in on the basis of flimsy claims of right. The real question is, when you are asking, was this authorized, who makes that decision? Who has the final decision about what is authorized? And I think under Oren's view of the world and the statute, that is up to the owner or the operator or some combination of owner and operator of the computer. And under my formulation, that's up to the court. Then the court gets to hear the question and make the decision about where right lies. So you don't get to do it because you have a subjective sense that you're right. You have to face the prospect that you might not persuade a court. But if you can persuade a court that you are justified in your hacking by the circumstances, then you ought to prevail and you shouldn't be guilty of a crime. On the other questions, I do think that we could handle many of these problems through the protective and law enforcement provision. Law enforcement agencies could experiment with hacking back today by authorizing or working with companies that want to engage in hacking back, as long as that's done under the authority of the law enforcement agency with the dramatic and detailed support of the victim, that's probably legal under either of our interpretations. I think the other argument, narrowly construing the statute or modifying the statute, is an interesting idea and worth considering.
Very good. Oren, do you want to take a minute for a quick response? Or
Yeah, I guess my quick thought is, Stuart and I both agree that ultimately a court is, it's up to a court to construe what is authorization. To the extent we're dealing with litigation over the issue, obviously a court is going to ultimately decide it. The question that we're disagreeing on is whether there is, you know, how uncertain this question is. Stuart sort of treats authorization as just an ink blot. We have no idea what authorization is, and so you can make your pitch to the judge that what you were doing was authorized. And my view of authorization is that we actually have principles from, you know, 25 years of cases, the text of the statute, the principles of the statute that show that it's about a trespass analogy of trying to apply that to computers. And so my view is that while, of course, we'll ultimately have a court resolve the issue, there's enough law there that trying to make a claim of authorization in the context that Stuart is suggesting is a bad legal argument that a court should reject. And I think that's where we're disagreeing.
Okay, we've got quite a few people on the phone. Let's get to their questions. In a moment, we should all hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to indicate you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either Stuart Baker or Professor Oren Kerr, you push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And while we're waiting to see if any of the audience members have questions, our lines are open, let me make a programming announcement. Tomorrow at 2 p.m. On a Teleforum conference call, we'll be discussing the Ring case, which will focus on some of the limits of federal crime. That's a case that arises out of the Jack Abramoff lobbying scandal of a few years ago. Then that's tomorrow at 2. Then Thursday at noon on a Teleforum conference call, we will be discussing one aspect of the implementation of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, and that's whether the IRS has the statutory authority to grant tax credits for federally created state-level insurance exchanges. I think everybody knows the Affordable Care Act requires state exchanges, and it clearly does grant the IRS statutory authority to give tax credits for those state-run state-level exchanges. The IRS has issued a rule asserting that it has the authority to grant tax credits for federally operated exchanges at the state level. So with that, it looks like we have one question, then our lines will be open. Push star and then pound if you have a question. Let's go to our first caller.
Hi, this is Will Shelley. I haven't read the statute, so I could be wrong on this. But one of you indicated that this was a lot like trespass law. Isn't there an exception to trespass generally that if, let's say, you and I were neighbors and I saw you take my bat and take it onto your property and I saw that bat on your property and I went and trespassed on your property to take that bat back, that would be an exception to trespass, wouldn't it?
This is Oren Kerr speaking. There are affirmative defenses that many state laws recognize that give limited powers to enter onto property to retrieve that property. It's in the nature of a necessity defense. So it's the kind of affirmative defense that we're talking about. But it's not considered to be a non-trespass. It's just that there's a special defense that allows some sorts of entering onto somebody's land to retrieve property. So we might be able to get to that same result in the online setting through the necessity defense. But we wouldn't say, well, it's authorized just because you're getting your own stuff. And so,
right.
So those affirmative defenses are pretty narrow.
Yeah, of course, I would say that precisely that. This is Stuart. I would say precisely that there are circumstances in which we do not allow the owner or an operator of the property to determine what's authorized and what's not, that sometimes social values trump the will of the owner-operator, and that that notion is incorporated into the concept of what's authorized and what's not.
All right, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open at this point. Oh, here's another question from a caller. So let's go to that next caller.
Hi, calling from the U.S. Senate, and I have a question about just the policy matter of the chilling effect. You know, regardless of whether a court would find hacking back to be permissible or not, wouldn't companies be chilled and deterred from even trying to do so because of that potential getting tripped up in court and the uncertainty of that?
This is Stuart. Let me start that, and Oren can take it on. But yes, I agree. That's exactly the case, that people are not going to lightly decide to engage in hacking back, and they're going to be very cautious about engaging in activity that causes harm to innocent parties' computers or otherwise invades the rights of innocent parties because they know they're at risk of being prosecuted. So I think that acknowledging the possibility that hacking back may in some circumstances be legal is not likely to produce a groundswell of hackbacks around the country precisely because of the chilling effect.
And this is Oren Kerr. I imagine, let's say we did recognize, or a court did recognize, there was some sort of exception for hacking back. I suspect that you'd get a lot of hacking back by 19-year-olds who saw a post on Slashdot who said, oh, now I can do this. And you'd see relatively little from corporate entities that have general counsels that actually read the opinions and say, wait a minute, this is much more narrow than we thought. So I suspect that kind of slightly opening the door would not make much of a difference to the sophisticated actors that Stuart seems to be focused on, and would probably make a really big difference, at least in initial conduct, to the folks that don't have a lot of sophistication. I agree that the law generally has a deterrent effect, but of course it's supposed to have a deterrent effect. The thought is that we don't want people generally doing this. But let me take the opportunity to push Stuart a little bit. Stuart, I think you're a little bit vague on exactly what you would allow people to do. So what is your answer, to the extent you have sort of worked out thoughts on this, as to what are the circumstances, what's the legal test you would say you would want as to when individuals are allowed to try to hack back to find out information? What kind of subjective state of mind do they need? How far can they go? What are they allowed to do? What if they, do they have to pay damages if it's an innocent actor who they, they mistarget? What kind of legal regime is your ideal that you would have in mind for this?
In an ideal world, I would say that it makes sense have some government oversight or standards for what is appropriate in responding to hacker attacks. And if I had to enunciate the principles that would apply in that context, it would be avoidance of harm to innocent parties. There's an enormous amount of value that can be obtained in attacking hackers by simply gathering information about them, by following them back from computer to computer to find out who's actually responsible for the hacking and what they're doing with the information that they have stolen. And gathering that information, being able to determine who's actually using the stolen information and potentially suing them for engaging in economic espionage is a very promising approach to the overall problem. And so if I were laying out those principles, it would be focus on gathering information rather than causing harm to the computers of people that you think are causing harm to you, and avoid actions that could cause collateral damage. I don't think that's the sort of thing you can write into a statute very comfortably, but I think those are also principles that someone who wants to make sure he's not held criminally responsible under a generalized view of authorization that should prevent them from engaging in that simply because of the deterrent or chilling effect of the criminal statute.
And this is Oren again. Stuart, if I can push it a little more, if Dean doesn't mind, would you limit your proposal to gathering information from computers outside the United States, or would you say it should also apply to computers located inside the United States?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and obviously it's not the statute we have. I think that the biggest problem is outside the United States. Inside the United States, in theory, you can get a court order that allows you to go into any computer in the United States to gather information. And so there's at least a plausible response that says inside the U.S., use legal process, and outside hack back to track the attackers. So it's at least plausible, and it has the additional advantage of encouraging people who are afraid of being hacked in the middle of their attacks to locate all of the evidence in the United States where the FBI can get it. So there are potentially valuable consequences to adopting that rule. I'd want to be a little cautious about that, because getting legal process in some circumstances can be very time-consuming, and in a few cases you might want to be able to pursue someone to a command and control server that is located in the United States, but which can't be followed quickly enough.
Very good. Oren, do you want to respond to that? What's wrong with the regime that Stuart Baker lays out there? And we do have three more audience members with questions, but I'd like to hear your response to Stuart's response.
I'm just not entirely sure how it would work. I mean, I think it's promising. The idea of maybe having one regime for inside the U.S., another for outside the U.S. is a possibility. You know, expanding 1030F is another possibility. I tend to think that whatever rule we're thinking of, it's just a question of, I like the idea of codifying whatever the rule is, so we at least have something written down. Granted, courts are going to have to interpret whatever standards adopted. But, I'm open to a middle ground, but I think we don't want to allow too much sort of uncontrolled intrusion. And it does seem like, it seems to me that Stuart's concern is actually a pretty specific set of facts, and that set of facts is one relatively small piece of the potential sort of overall picture of hacking back. So I think it's important, if there is a response, that it be limited to the kind of thing that Stuart has in mind.
Okay, we now have two audience members with questions, so let's go to the next caller.
Hey guys, it's Paul Rosenzweig. How are you?
Hey, Paul.
Hey,
wouldn't miss this for the world. This one is actually mostly for Stuart, though I'd welcome your comments, Oren. Stuart, I'm like totally on board with your plan, but how about this? I have to assume that any hackback by an American company outside the United States would be a violation of the domestic law of any of country where the hacking occurred, both the transit countries and the ultimate. I certainly know it would be a violation of German law, French law, English law, and I suspect it would be a violation of Chinese law, domestic law. Is your response, A, that we shouldn't care because we'd never extradite an American to China because of that, or B, that that's a problem that needs to be solved before companies can actually extraterritorially hack back?
Those are great questions. This is Stuart. I have to say I don't have a complete answer to those questions. It does seem to me that the international aspect of this is the hardest. I'm not unduly concerned about the what's a violation of Chinese law, because of course you're pursuing people who violated U.S. law in many cases from China and seem not to be particularly worried about it. I also think that the likelihood of an extradition, even to allied countries, is relatively low if you buy my approach to what's authorized and what's not, because the treaty that we've entered into with some of our closest allies about preventing hacking and treating it as a crime only treats things as a crime if they are actions without right. So it's probably even easier under a without right argument or regime to argue that there is a right to hack back in certain circumstances. So I would say overall, there are going to be international law problems here. I think that in extreme circumstances where it's clearly a crime, I would be inclined to rely on the argument that I have a right to do this and at least defeat an effort to extradite and perhaps persuade other countries that this is not a violation of their law either, since many of these countries actually just use the convention as their statutory basis.
Yeah, and this is Oren speaking. And, you know, I think the international context is a huge problem. A lot of the reason why the U.S. added foreign computers outside the U.S. to the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act in 2001 was because we wanted other countries to do the same for their versions of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. So most industrialized countries, as Paul certainly knows, have their own version of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And so whatever solution you come up with is not only got to be a U.S. solution, it's an every country solution. And so if U.S. courts come up with a novel interpretation of without right, then certainly other countries can do the same, and it can be totally okay. You know, you can imagine the Fredonia Supreme Court saying it's always authorized to hack into the United States because we hate the United States, and then it becomes perfectly legal to hack into the United States computer from Fredonia. So you know, the international problem, I think, is a major. Major problem, and there's no doubt that any effort to try to say foreign computers are okay, there's a green light for those computers, is going to run into a lot of resistance for that reason.
We have one more caller with a question. If you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. It seems that we are developing confusion from trying to apply principles applicable to the law of real property to cyberspace and running into a lot of trouble, including the problem of territorial jurisdiction. Let me suggest that perhaps the Congress and the courts really don't have jurisdiction over this area, and furthermore, that until the Constitution is amended, they won't have. Now, there's also a problem that everyone as militia, and we are all militia, have the authority to investigate crimes, and by original understanding, to actually file complaints with grand juries, and by receiving indictments, to prosecute them privately. But as such, almost any of this hacking back can be covered under proper investigation if done properly and not in violation of Fourth Amendment standards. Would you care to comment on that?
Well, I think you've certainly identified the fact that there are a lot of authorities that people use and that have been hallowed by time in the Constitution that are neither exactly government nor exactly private, and that we're pretty comfortable with the idea that there might be a militia. To my mind, that indicates that we shouldn't be too demanding, so we shouldn't insist that we know exactly what authorization means in this context, and it can't possibly mean private action, no matter how justified. So I that's where I would come out on that issue. I wanted to come back to one point that we talked about earlier, which was the international issue. There's no doubt that the question of private action to hack hackers raises international questions, but really the same is true for government action. That is to say, if the FBI pursues hackers who have broken into the Federal Bureau of Investigation network, finds that they have a command and control server in Russia or Romania, and they pursue those hackers, break into that command and control server, and identify the hackers, there's going to be international repercussions. It's quite possible that the Russians or the Romanians will say that's a violation of our law, just as they could say it if it were Exxon that did it. So we don't solve the international problem by saying government has a monopoly on hacking under the CFAA. We just displace it make the international issue more a fight between states than between states and individual parties.
Well, if I may follow up, perhaps we could also extend the notion of piracy and defense against piracy.
Yes, I think you're right. You could imagine a letter of marque being issued to Exxon saying, yes, we know you're under attack by people who look like this and behave like that, and we authorize you to attack them wherever you find them, or to exploit them and bring us back the evidence wherever you find them. The letter of marque was indeed a response to the difficulty of actually enforcing the law on the high seas, and the response was to make everybody a law enforcer.
Looks like we have one more caller with a question at this point. Again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Dave Wilson. I have a quick scenario and sort of a two-part question, and I just wanted to get your thoughts on it. Let's say, Stuart, as you've described in some of your writings, there's a company that is being decimated pretty much, losing thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars either weekly or monthly. They've tried everything else. Their security is good security, and they're sort of taking an escalated approach to this, getting to the point where the leadership decide we have no other choice, but we have to go block this attack at some point outside of our network. I wanted to get your thoughts on that, whether you would see that as sort of a scenario that would be viable under this, certainly under the self-defense approach. And then your thoughts on the recent Auerheimer case and how that may impact this.
I'm not familiar with the Auerheimer case.
That's the guy who was, they say, called it slurping email addresses from AT&T.
And oh, yes.
And it was convicted under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
Oh, yes.
And from my reading of it, I don't see that there was unauthorized intrusion into a computer, but I haven't read the whole case, so.
Okay. It is the companies that are in this situation that have really driven me to reconsidering the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act conventional wisdom, because this is happening to everyone. It is a routine tactic now. If you sue a Chinese state-owned enterprise, you will be intruded upon, and so will your law firm. And we haven't seen the end of what this could mean. It's only a step, and there's at least some evidence that perhaps that step's been taken in some cases, from breaking in and stealing information to breaking in and wrecking information, destroying businesses by destroying files. Indeed, the We are steps away from the world that George Orwell imagined, in which Big Brother sits inside the screen that is in your living room and on your desk, watching you, listening to you, understanding your thoughts as you form them and type the words on the keyboard, and that is an authoritarian government that will punish you for the wrong thoughts and the wrong behavior by making your interaction with the rest of the world far more difficult than everyone else's. All of that is really within the realm of the possible at this point. And if we don't want to live in a world like that, we need to find a way to solve the security problem we face. And to my mind, the best way to do that is to make sure that the people who are breaking in reconsider their career choice, because it's not as much fun as it used to be. And that's overall what I would say is the goal here. A company in this position, I think, has to look pretty carefully. Orrin Kerr is a well-regarded academic, and he certainly knows a lot about the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, and I think he probably reflects the views of a large chunk of the Justice Department's prosecutorial force. So you're taking a risk there. If I were doing this, if I were giving advice to someone in this circumstance, and I have on occasion, I would urge real caution, particularly because, as Orrin says, there is a way to do this that is almost beyond doubt protected, which is work with law enforcement. You need their authority. You do not need them to be the world's most competent computer jocks themselves. You hire the jocks, put them at the disposal of law enforcement that is inclined to view this crime seriously, and between the two, you've got both capability and authority. And to my mind, that's a most straightforward way to deal with the problem. As for the Allenheimer case, he discovered that you could query the database, if I remember right, and by querying the database, you could, with respect to plausible email addresses, you could acquire the email credentials of people, and he acquired, I think, 100,000 credentials on iPads from AT&T. That sounds to me as though it's not authorized, and he certainly acted as though he was doing it not to vindicate any right, but for, as I think he put it, the lulls. He thought it would be fun to embarrass AT&T by releasing this data, and if it did harm to the individuals whose credentials were exposed, that was just part of the lulls. So I think that prosecuting him probably was a good idea, but I haven't delved into exactly how he violated the authorization clause.
Professor Kerr, do you want to weigh in here?
Sure. So I agree with Stuart's reaction that the way to proceed, if you're a company in the situation that Stuart has suggested, the way to proceed, I think, generally would be to work with law enforcement and then also to keep in mind the necessity defense and try to limit your conduct to the kind of contours that would fit within the necessity defense. I mean, if you contact the Justice Department and they're willing to help you and provide the 1030F authority for the conduct that you are engaging in, it's awfully difficult for the Justice Department to then turn around and prosecute you for your conduct, the prospect of extradition seems incredibly unlikely if some foreign government were to try to bring an indictment on their end. There was a case, United States versus Gorshkov, in which an FBI agent accessed the Russian an account on a server in Russia where a hacker had kept his hacker tools. And the FBI agent logged in, got the hacker tools, saved the tools to a file in the U.S., and then got a warrant to open up the file and take a look at it. And then when this was leaked, he was indicted in one of the former Soviet republics, I forget which, and so it did lead to some international attention on this question. I think eventually it just kind of went away. But cooperating with the federal government on this issue, I think, is the wise course. I'd be interested to, I don't know if we'll ever find out, at least publicly, if the federal government is cooperating in these cases, if that's working at all. But it does seem, at least based on the current statutory scheme, to be the most promising way forward to deal with that particular kind of situation.
Warren, could I just add a follow-up there? I understand, you know, you're an alumnus of the Justice Department CSIPs, but this is not something where you would have to go to the Justice Department. You could go to a law enforcement agency, a protective agency, which means certainly the Secret Service, and if I remember, local. You could go to the Alameda County Sheriff. You don't have to wander into to Washington to get the protection of subparagraph F, do you?
That's true. The subparagraph F doesn't apply just to DOJ. It applies pretty broadly, including to state agencies. The tactical benefit, I'm just thinking purely from a standpoint of advising.
It's harder for them to prosecute.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Hey, Joe, you're the one who said we could do this. What are you talking about? So it's a little tougher if somebody's, trying to find some cop in a small town somewhere and saying, hey, can we do this? And they say, okay, and then, makes it a little bit tougher. But you're absolutely right that exception, which to my understanding, there's no cases interpreting that section. So exactly what it means really is kind of a mystery. But by its plain language, whatever it means, it applies equally to federal, state agencies, to law enforcement and intelligence agencies, protective agencies. It's pretty broad coverage.
So let me, unless there are more questions, I do want to kind of close with.
We do, Stuart.
You have more? Okay.
Yeah, we have one more question. If we could get to that, and then we'll take your answers and then final thoughts.
Hi, I'm this is Edwin Williamson. This is a very interesting program. I apologize, I got interrupted a couple of times, but and I also want to apologize because I realize this is pretty much a program. The program is sponsored by the Criminal Law Group, and it's you're basically addressing basically domestic issues and how they apply to private actors. But I was sort of struck, Stuart, by your opening comments that just the underlying logic of it all sounds very much like what I've been sort of saying when I asked that the way it would work in the public international law arena when it comes down to issues of self-defense, reaction against hostile cyber attacks, and it seems to me that just the basic principles of self-defense would apply. And again, we're not dealing with specific statutes as you and Oren are, but it is a seems to me a sort of pretty commonsensical sort of analysis. And am I?
I'm with you. This is Stuart. If I remember right, such international law as I have been willing to remember, the concept of self-defense allows you to take action against persons in another country's territory if that country is unable or unwilling to enforce the law and prevent the attacks. That pretty much defines the state of cyberspace today. Many of the places that would be the subject of hackback that could in theory prosecute are unable and maybe unable and unwilling to actually prevent hacking attacks from their territory because they benefit from them. And in those circumstances, if you borrow those principles from international law, you've got a reasonable argument in response to complaints about the activity.
Professor Curdy, you want to weigh in here?
Oh, with my apologies to Edwin, I know so little of that topic that I will stay away from trying to weigh in.
That's the great thing about public international law. You can make it up as you go along.
That's always been my view, is that it means whatever we want it to mean.
Okay, well, thank you all. That was a very, 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 very good program.
We've got a couple minutes left here. Let me give each of you an opportunity to wrap up in the order we started, I think. Stuart Baker?
Well, I think this is a useful addition to the written debate that Orrin and I have had, because I think we found far more common ground today than we did when we were in full Supreme Court briefing mode. It does seem to me there's agreement that this is a very serious problem, that we don't see another solution, that hacking back in some circumstances is an option that ought to be on the table with restrictions and oversight, and that the question then becomes what restrictions, what oversight, implemented how. And if we've gotten to that point, then I think we should be asking ourselves, and Orrin, maybe we can talk about this in the future. So how would you modify the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act to make this kind of activity legal and properly disciplined?
And this is Orrin, just a concluding thought. I mean, I think Stuart's most powerful argument is really coming from the facts here. And if, you know, he's the one who's privy to what's going on. Stuart, correct me if I'm wrong, but you said that, you know, if you sue a Chinese, the Chinese government or some Chinese entity, the company gets hacked and the lawyers get hacked, and you know, if that's going on, and the more people know about that, and the more people think about how do you respond to that specific problem, I'm more confident that there's an answer to the extent we're dealing with a specific situation with a clear set of facts and an existing problem. And to my mind, that puts this question pretty far removed from the broader issue of, you know, if there's an 18-year-old and a 20-year-old and they don't like each other because they like different bands or something like that, you know, can they hack back and hack into each other in revenge? So we're dealing with a specific kind of issue, and I think there may be a way of narrowly tailoring some sort of answer to that problem.
Well, I think we can leave it there.
That's a great place to end, I think. Let me thank you both, Professor Orrin Kerr and Stuart Baker, for joining us today. This has been very interesting. To our audience, thank you, as always, for joining and for your thoughtful questions. Again, to the audience, I invite you to join us for our next scheduled teleform conference call tomorrow at 2 p.m. on the Ring case and the limits of criminalization, of federal criminalization. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.